You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Richard Thompson is my guest. He is a legendary guitarist, singer, songwriter, and music historian. He was a founding member of Fairport Convention. He made several albums as half of Richard and Linda Thompson, which have recently been collected into a fine box set called Hard Luck Stories. And Richard Thompson has recorded many solo records, including his most recent, 13 Rivers. And he has performed extensively for the last half century. Richard Thompson has written a memoir, and it's called Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. Richard Thompson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
I love this book because with so many memoirs, you know, you really want them to sort of start with chapter two. And then lots of them go on way past the period where you're really interested in the person. But your book just really focuses on 1967 to 1975. So what made you focus on that period exactly?
Well, it was a great time for me. Being a teenager, you know, starting out in music, everything was very very alive and very memorable in that period. Yeah, but being in London, you know, at the time of the sort of psychedelic explosion with Pink Floyd and all those bands, Jimi Hendrix, you know, it seemed like a special time then. And I think down the decades, it's continued to have quite a strong reverberation, and people still seem to, you know, listen to Dark Side of the Moon and, you know, the Are You Experienced and things like that. So, and people ask me about that period a lot. So I thought it was a good time to write about. And I agree with you about many of the biographies that one reads, that you kind of get bored about two thirds of the way through. And again, some of the early stuff is pretty irrelevant. So I wanted to jump straight in and then jump right out again.
Yeah. There are people who are like very like narrow in their musical tastes. They only listen to the music that they listen to between junior high school and marriage usually. But I think that's why a lot of people were surprised when you recorded or performed live. Oops, I Did It Again, the Britney Spears song. That like, oh, you mean he listens to music?
Up to a point. I honestly could not say that I'm in touch with popular music. I mean, I think I lost that ability in about 1974 to kind of keep up, you know. But sometimes I hear things that I really like, and I'll make a note of them. There's always great young artists, you know, in any generation, and you have to kind of discover who they are and focus on the good stuff.
When Bee's Wings gets started, it felt like maybe you were almost reluctant to look back. Was it difficult for you to do this?
It was difficult in some places, joyful in other places. Fairport, like a lot of bands, went through you know, convolutions, went through tragedies, heartbreaks, and wonderful times. So I really didn't want to shy away from anything. The writing process probably brought a lot of things to the front of my consciousness that I hadn't really been dealing with. And in some cases, that was good. That was a cathartic thing in some cases to look at things in a new light with some perspective of time and lay them to rest a bit more.
Did you have journals that you could look at, or were you just relying on your memory, or?
I so wish I kept a journal. That would have been a massive help. One of the hardest things was the chronology. It was easy, you know, and lots of fun to write the anecdotal stuff. Trying to figure out where everything fit was really, really difficult. And I had to rely on, you know, websites that specialize in, you know, Fairport Convention tour dates from 1967 onwards. And even those are patchy, you know, they're not complete either. In some cases, you know, you know, Brian Epstein agency that used to book us, you know, I had records of dates that we played. But it was, that was the hardest part of the thing was to make it into something that had some sort of logical sequence to it.
Have you, I'm sure you have, you must have gotten emails instantly. You are wrong when you said that you did this and that.
not yet, surprisingly enough. And the wonderful thing is, you know, if you have a publishing house that publishes your book, you have editors. And the last guy they send in is the guy who's like fanatically all about the details. So he goes through and says, "Well, actually, you couldn't have seen that band then because you know they changed their name in March of that year, and you saw them in February." You know, the really tiny stuff it gets really picked up. Plus all the legal stuff. You know, all the people you're about to libel. You know. Very careful about that stuff. So I tried to just libel dead people.
They can't hurt you. Did you have to get permissions from people to use their real names or any of that?
Yeah, I think so. I didn't say anything nasty really about too many people. I was fairly nice, and so I didn't really seek permission because I couldn't see the point. There's things like copyright, which is a pain in the nuts to deal with, but where, you know, I think I'm doing people a favor by quoting a couple of lines from one of their songs, and their publisher says, "Well, you know, we're going to have to charge you for that. It's going to cost you, you know." And I'm saying, "Well, I'm, you know, the people who read the book might want to go and buy the record of this artist, and I'd be doing you a favor." But so there was all that absolute bullshit to get through. But there wasn't. I don't think it was too. There wasn't too much of asking, you know, other people for permission.
You tell your story in a really straightforward way with not a whole lot of hindsight, but there's a little bit of that. And I was wondering about your thoughts that you might be learning disabled when you looked back at your school years.
Yeah. Well, I never liked school.
And that might be why. I mean, a reason I ask is because I have a learning disability and I didn't know it when I was in school. And it wasn't until I was 28 and I decided to go back to college that they actually diagnosed it. And it was like, oh.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, yeah. I think I was more musically dyslexic than literally dyslexic, but I always had a speech impediment, and that was a real difficult thing to overcome because school kids can be pretty cruel, you know. If you're stammering in class, you know, that can be really brutal and doesn't help at all. I mean, it makes it worse actually. So I think music in many ways was a refuge from that, you know. It was a place where I could be myself with it without being picked on, you know, by the kids.
I stuttered also. Did you get over your stuttering just over time, or did you get help with your stuttering?
I got help, but it didn't necessarily work. I mean, I still stutter a bit, you know. I still stumble over words, as you can hear from time to time now. But I suppose at some point it got better and I learned how to deal with it, and you know, it's hard to say what the cause is. You know, in my case, might have been, you know, being whacked by my dad. That's a possibility. I think some cases your brain's going too fast for your mouth.
I found when I had memorized things, then I didn't stutter. So maybe singing was a way to get over it for you.
Yeah, if you sing, you don't stutter at all. That's the interesting thing. In that wonderful film, The King's Speech, I don't know if you saw that, where you know King George VI of England is trying to cure his stutter, and his elocution teacher plays some music. He puts on a Bach record and he says, "Okay, now read the same passage that you stumble over," and of course, it's perfect. But while the music's playing, he has no problem whatsoever because there's something else going on and he's not focused on the details of the words. So, you know, there's all kinds of tricks, I suppose, that one can do to help that situation. But I think it's very important if you know someone who does stutter, not to take the piss out of them, as we say in England, but to give them a break and be very understanding and patient.
We try not to make fun of people anymore.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think yes. You sometimes seem, in terms of the hindsight that you do show in the book, a little exasperated with your younger self, you failed to attend a Beatles party because what, you were a musical snob?
If I had the time again, I would probably go. But perhaps he'll invite me to his 80th party. You know, McCartney. Perhaps he'll ask me along to another one, and I will go. I think I just thought the Beatles were, you know, a kind of a pop band, and I wasn't really interested in that. I was really into, you know, singer songwriters and Dylan and Phil Oakes and people like that. You know, that was more my cup of tea. But I was being very snobbish, and I think Fairport as a band, we were kind of snobs, really, and we thought we were better than other people around the London music scene. We thought what we did was distinct and different, and but we were real idealists, you know, and really thought that we lived in our own little world.
Well, many of the 60s groups, like the Byrds, for instance, cite the Beatles as key influences, and of course many people since then cite the Beatles. So the Beatles not an influence, or what were influences for you?
Well, it's funny. It's almost as if we ignored the Beatles, but we loved the American answer to the Beatles, which was, you know, bands like the Byrds, you know, and Love, you know, these sort of Los Angeles bands, rather probably than the San Francisco bands. But we liked the answer to the Beatles, the Left Bank, you know, a band like that. We're very Beatle influenced, but had a unique style and sensibility. So, yeah, perhaps we liked our Beatles kind of redigested and thrown back at us.
And before you became a musician, what were the musical things that you enjoyed listening to, or that you think permeated into Richard Thompson?
Well, you know, I loved everything. You know, I grew up with music around the house. First of all, you know, my father had some good jazz records in among the, you know, the musicals and the, you know, the show tunes. That there were, you know, Duke Ellington and Django Reinhardt and Les Paul, you know. So I was hearing that from the very young age. Lots of French records from World War II, you know, when my father was in France. Lots of like Edith Piaf and stuff. Very influential on me. Plus, you know, Scottish dance music and Scottish ballads, bagpipe music. And then from my big sister, the rock and roll stuff, you know, Elvis, lots of Buddy Holly, lots of Jerry Lee Lewis. So that was all kind of in this big mishmash of things that I was listening to before I restarted, you know, thinking about what my musical style was or about writing music.
We're talking with Richard Thompson, who was a founding member of the band Fairport Convention, and let's listen to one of Richard Thompson's compositions that was recorded by Fairport Convention in the summer of 1968, and it's called Meet on the Ledge.
We used to say that come the day we'd all be making songs, oh, finding better words. These ideas never lasted long. The way is up along the road, the air is growing thin. Too many friends who try, blown off this mountain.
Meet on the Ledge from Fairport Convention, featuring Richard Thompson, who composed the song. He's just written a brand new book. It's called Bee's Wing. Losing My Way, and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. And we'll continue our conversation right after this short break. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSEO. Don't go away. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with musician Richard Thompson, a founding member of the band Fairport Convention, part of Richard and Linda Thompson, and he's just written a brand new book called Beeswing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. Judy Dybel was an English singer-songwriter, a founding member of Fairport Convention, and I learned in your book, Richard Thompson, Beeswing, that you had been involved with her for a while. She passed away in July of 2020, and I wonder if you have any memories of her that you'd like to share.
Judy was a lovely person, is a very sweet girl, smart, real music lover, folk aficionado as well. And I mean, she really loved traditional music styles of all kinds from all over the world. And she and I went out for a year or two, probably a year before Fairport. And then during probably the first year of Fairport, we were still going out with each other. And sometimes that gets hard, being in a band together and having a relationship. And I think our relationship slowly faded away as the band got stronger and stronger. And at a certain point, Judy dropped out of the band, and we didn't really see each other after that for a while.
She decided to leave the band. The band decided they wanted to go in a different direction, or which was it?
I think she had a very pure kind of a folk voice. I'm trying to think who she sounded maybe like. Like Jackie McShay or someone from Pentangle. Like a soprano voice. And it was difficult for her to sing over a band that was getting louder and louder. I mean, we started out fairly polite volume level, but then to compete with the other bands around London, we had to get a bit louder. And Judy's voice wasn't strong enough to sing over that. And then I think by mutual consent, Judy left the band and Sandy Denny came in. We had a much stronger voice.
I love Judy Dybel's recording of I Talk to the Wind, Talk to the Trees. That was a song that was a King Crimson song later. I love that record. So Sandy Denny came along and she auditioned you as well as you auditioning her.
I think that's fair enough too. Sandy had a certain reputation around the folk scene in the UK. She'd been doing that for a couple of years. people said she was a great singer, good songwriter, and so we auditioned her, and then she said, okay, I want to hear what you guys do now. She was aware of her own worth and wasn't gonna throw her lot in with a bunch of no-hopers, so it was a mutual audition, but I think we all liked each other pretty much from the get-go. There wasn't any hesitation about hiring Sandy.
The quality that she has to her voice. I mean, it's not only a very pretty voice, but it's got some kind of a certain thing to it. Can you define what that is? A certain.
Yeah, I think of it the way you do. It's a certain thing. It's an emotion to it, but it's almost an emotion that not many singers have. It's a special emotion, and it's there, whatever she sings, it's just present. It's in her being. Sandy was an emotional human being. I mean, she absolutely, had ups and downs, all the time. She rode an emotional roller coaster throughout her life. And I think it's very reflected in her voice. But there's many other things in there as well. There's a kind of a calmness about her voice as well. And a kind of a certainty about her voice. Lots and lots of things. I'd love to hear other people's comments about what they like about Sandy's voice. But it was certainly a very special voice. Technically, she was a really, really great singer. Never sang out of tune. Had a big, big range. Could sing from a whisper to a scream. I mean, she could do everything, absolutely everything. One of the greatest singers I've ever heard in my life.
And do you think that she required a life of turmoil in which to perform her art. I mean, I think she's not the only singer then that you could say that about. Certainly Judy Garland or Billie Holiday had similar, and she's up there with them as a vocalist. Is that something that's part of being her special kind of artist?
Well, I don't know which comes first. I don't know if you are this emotional human being and then you become a musician, or if being a musician makes you an emotional human being. perhaps, you know, having the creative outlet is important for someone like Sandy or like Billie Holiday, where you can just go up on stage and express that and become this other person almost, you know, in the creative process. But it would take a psychologist to really give you a better answer on that.
But you guys had fun a lot of the time together.
Well, we did, yeah. I mean, Sandy was great fun. She could also be, you know, a pain in the ass sometimes. She could be, you know, very despondent, very depressed, or lots of fun, happy, laughing. You know, she was emotional. And, you know, the drink and the drugs probably made her life more of a seesaw. You're never quite sure who you were going to get with Sandy, but when I think of her, I think of the good times. I think of her, you know, being just a lot of fun to be with.
So you, at some point, she left the group, and then was that before your accident or after your accident? You had a terrible car accident.
Yeah. Well, in 1969, we had an accident which killed our drummer, killed my girlfriend. And that was a deep, deep trauma for the band. And at that point, we said, well, we're going to ditch our whole repertoire. We're not playing the songs that we played with our drummer. Again, we're just going to say goodbye to those. And we're going to strike out in this whole new direction where we're going to be much more influenced by British traditional music, and we're going to wed that to you know, amplified guitars and drums and everything. And this will be a new, different genre, musical genre. So we did that about 6 months after we did an album called Legion Leaf, which was a kind of a statement of that direction. And then Sandy left the band and Ashley left the band. You know, for various reasons. I mean, I just think I describe it in the book that you know, we felt that Sandy kind of had pulled away from the band and was about to leave anyway. And so we just kind of said, well, we're going to give you that last push because this is not working very well.
Well, you know, audiences love to, and you've talked a little bit about this in your book, you know, they want you to play your greatest hits and so how did audiences respond when you jettisoned all of the material that they had previously come to love?
Well, I don't really know, which is a shameful thing to say, but we weren't too concerned about the audience reaction. But we very idealistically thought, well, they'll tag along with us, whatever we do. And perhaps they'll be impressed by our kind of ruthless determination to be original and different. Which is a pretty arrogant point of view, but we didn't pay much attention. We just plowed onwards.
So you didn't care if they wanted. Did they start calling out for Meat on the Ledge, and you would ignore it, or?
No, not really. But very few people did. I mean, there must have been disappointed elements in the audience, and I know friends who were disappointed that we ditched everything. I mean, we got back to it. Eventually. You know, the old repertoire after about 30 years, but it took a while. It took a long time to get there. So we just really had to do what we did and hoped that the audience would be with us. You know, and they were. I mean, the audience responded really enthusiastically about the new material.
Well,
and we didn't really look backwards, you know.
Well, it was absolutely great. What a wonderful record it is. I love that record. But you just touched on something. A lot of bands who were together then and then later realized that there was an audience for them to come back and play again. I think they might have, if they had looked back, you know, I'm thinking of groups like the Eagles or Crosby, Stills and Nash. If they had sort of treasured what they had at the moment, they might have done greater work or had a longer life as a band. And you left Fairport, and I mean, you didn't particularly have a plan when you left, according to your book. Do you regret that? Do you think maybe that original lineup should have been held together as much as possible?
Well, I think that we were all quite traumatized from the accident. And I think that manifested in various ways for the next couple of years. And I think we didn't always make the wisest decisions. And I think people leaving the band, Sandy leaving the band, Ashley leaving the band, maybe that they wouldn't have in different circumstances. So, you know, what happened. I left because I just felt that I'd been in bands since I was, 12 years old, and I needed a change, really. And, what is the life of a band anyway? I think if a band sticks together for 10 years, they've done really well. If you manage to keep all the egos in check, keep everybody happy for that long, you've done a really good job.
Have you heard of that band, the Rolling Stones? They've been playing together a long time.
Yeah, but how often do they actually get together, as human beings? Every 5 years. It could be more frequent than that, but it's not like they're hanging out together, writing songs together all the time.
Living in an old pub.
Yeah, exactly. to be a real band, full-time band, you really are living cheek by jowl, and it's like being in the army sometimes. You do get sick of people, you're thrown together with people, and it's a good job if you get on, because you're gonna have to spend a lot of downtime in dressing rooms and on airplanes and God knows what, and traveling, lots of traveling. So it's a miracle that bands do stay together.
Well, Richard Thompson, in your book Beeswing, you also talk about not realizing that the future would ever arrive, that you made some decisions in your life that you just didn't think that there would ever be consequences to, or you didn't give thought to those consequences. You fathered a child, for instance, without giving any thought to it at all.
I suppose that's
being a kid.
I think in some cases it's being a kid. I think it's also music not being a recognized profession, like popular music not being a recognized profession. So you think, I'll do this for 6 months, a year, as long as I can, because it's fun. And then when it all goes wrong, then I'll go back to college. I'll get that straight job. I'll do the job that my parents want me to do. I'll go in the family business. So it's almost like your passport's run out, but they're going to give you a 6 month extension, and then you get another extension, until you look in the rearview mirror and you think, gosh, I've been doing this for 5 years now. Perhaps I really am a professional musician. but it took a long time to sink in, really. I was in my 40s, and my parents came to see me, but playing to a sellout concert at London's Festival Hall, and they come backstage afterwards and they say, well dear, now are you going to settle down now and get that proper job? They still hadn't quite realized that it was a valid profession. They still thought it was just this stupid thing that kids did for a bit of fun, and at some point you really had to be more responsible in life. So, it always seemed, amazing that you could have this much fun. You could do this great job. I still look back and think, my God, I've been doing this for so long, and it's what I want to do. And so many people don't do what they want to do, but I do just the best job in the world. It's so much, it's so wonderfully rewarding.
My mother is 89. She still says to me, you know what you could do?
I love it.
Well, I want to ask a little bit about this box set of your work as Richard and Linda Thompson that just came out, Hard Luck Stories. It's wonderful to hear all this music again. Did you have a hand in putting together in that box set, and how do you feel about it being out there?
Well, not so much a hand as a sort of a small finger, as a pinky finger.
Yeah.
Of influence. basically, Universal wanted to do it, and they wanted to know that we'd be on board. Myself and Linda would be on board with it. And then then they ran the music by us, and we had power of veto. So some stuff we did veto. Other stuff we kind of bit our lips and said, well, okay, if you must, you know, but put some stuff. Because, you know, some stuff is unfinished. Songs that weren't really finished. Some stuff is alternate takes. Some stuff is B-sides. And there's a reason that stuff generally stays on the cutting room floor. You know, you don't want that stuff released. So we were trying to be, you know, nice to Universal Records and nice to the, you know, the fanatical collectors who want to hear everything and might be disappointed that we left off some half-baked thing, you know, that we weren't very happy with. So so it was a sort of combination of us having a little bit of veto, but mostly Universal putting it together.
Well, what about the albums themselves as you intended them? Is it nice that they're available and people can hear them? Do you still enjoy those records?
I think it's great. There's some albums I think work really well. I mean, something like I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight, which we did in 1973, I think, hangs together very well as a record.
It sounds very contemporary, I have to say.
Well, it does. I mean, it doesn't sound dated because I think we recorded it very naturalistically. We just tried to get the best sounds that we could without, you know, any trendy phasing or you know, reverb or anything on the records. So they do tend to stand up pretty well. You know, often I think more in terms of songs than in terms of albums. You know, there are songs that I like that I still play in concert, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years later. Other songs I don't ever want to play. So albums for me are often patchy things where, you know, I like three tracks or four tracks. Mm-hmm. I don't like the rest. So songs I like, and I there are some that I keep close to my heart and others that I don't ever want to hear again.
what's it like when your song is covered? And I mean, your songs have been covered a lot. They've been tribute albums and everything else. But like if Tom Jones records one of your songs, what is that like? Is that a strange feeling to hear Tom Jones sing your song?
Yes, it's really strange. I mean, when someone said, oh, Tom Jones has covered your song, I wow, that's fantastic. I'm quite impressed by that. I mean, I think that's really great. Tom Jones' version is very much based, I think, on the Blind Boys of Alabama version,
yeah,
which is a long way removed from my version. So I had to kind of think, okay, he's doing it that way as opposed to he's doing it this way. But I mean, I've been a huge fan of Tom Jones for years, forever, you know. So I was very thrilled that he'd do that.
Oh, I think it's terrific, and I think he's an amazing guy, misunderstood
he's
guy.
Great singer. Yeah.
So your songs are out there in the world. Is that what is that? That must be a wonderful feeling, I would think.
Yeah, I think it's the best feeling in some ways. It's nice if you know, if the audience likes you, that you know that's great. You know, if but if your fellow musicians like you, you know, that is something special. So if someone would take the trouble to cover one of your songs, I mean, that really is a great feeling and a very rewarding feeling.
Well, I would think that, you know, like if people who didn't know Richard and Linda Thompson or didn't know Fairport Convention and they're, you know, maybe they're punks or new wave fans, and then they heard Elvis Costello singing Withered and Died, they went, well, what's that song? And then they come and find you.
Well, that's often the way it happens. I think these days people find you through things like Spotify, you know, they find you through streaming services or where you know, you say, yeah, just give me, you know, folk rock or something. And so you might get a track by me, you might get a track by Nick Drake, you know, one of my contemporaries, or a Sandy Denny track, you know. And I hope that opens doors for people. It should do. You know, it's a different version of word of mouth. You know, word of mouth gets people to concerts, I think, quite a lot. In my case, if you don't sell a lot of albums traditionally, which I haven't, then word of mouth brings people to shows. And I think these days, things like streaming services will probably bring people to your music another way. So it's a good thing. If they just pay me, I'd be very happy. That'd be great.
This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro here on KSCO. And my guest this week is Richard Thompson. He was a musician who was a founding member of the band Fairport Convention. And he also toured and recorded with his wife, Linda Thompson, as Richard and Linda Thompson for a while in the 1970s. And here's one of their great records. It's called I Want to See the Bright Lights Tonight. I want to see the bright lights tonight from Richard and Linda Thompson. Richard Thompson, my guest this week on From the Bookshelf. He's just written a new book. It's called Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975.
You mentioned Nick Drake, so let me ask you about him. You know, I think he was definitely underappreciated in his lifetime. And right. And then came a commercial. I think it was a Volkswagen commercial or something that had Pink Moon in it. And all of a sudden, everybody was like, whoa, who's this guy? And now he has a huge following.
Well, you know that they say the cream rises to the surface. Sometimes it takes a long time for the cream to get there. In Nick's case, I mean, it took a VW ad to bring him to people's attention. But he was so underrated in his lifetime. I think people didn't know what to do with him though, because he didn't fit categories very well. You know, there's a kind of a jazz influence in there. There's a kind of Brazilian influence in there, but at the same time, he's incredibly English, and there's a Bert Jansch influence in there, and there's his mother's influence in there. His mother was this, you know, sort of stay-at-home mom who wrote these songs on the piano, a bit like Noel Coward or Ivan Novello, you know, and you can hear her in Nick's music as well. So Nick was kind of a unique blend of things, but, you know, great singer, great guitar player. And it's taken this long, really, for people to really take notice. He might have sold, you know, 2,000 records in his lifetime. He died young, I should say. He died at 27 or something. Sometimes it just does take a really long time. But I'm delighted and very happy that people have finally latched onto Nick. And I get asked more about Nick Drake than anybody.
Huh.
People say, you know, what was Nick like? You know,
what was he like as a live performer?
Well, he hardly ever played live. I mean, I'm only aware of about maybe 8 occasions when he actually stood up on a stage and played. Huh. And 4 of those were probably while he was at Cambridge University, you know, just playing in the university folk club or something. So very few live performances. He was very uncomfortable on stage playing live. Which is weird because at the same time, he had this kind of presence to him. You know, he's quite tall and a handsome guy, you know. And I think he was quite charismatic on stage, but he didn't like the experience. Famously, when they released his record in the States, they did a kind of a, you know, like a promotional event for him in Los Angeles. And they had a life-size cardboard cutout of Nick, you know, to put up on the stage. And then they played his record. That was the best they could do because there's no way he was flying out to LA to actually play. So, you know, there's reasons, apart from his kind of uniqueness, there's reasons that he wasn't that popular in his lifetime. And that's a big one of them.
Right. He didn't turn into Elton John.
No, absolutely not.
So in your book, Beeswing, Richard Thompson, you talk about having a spiritual awakening in your life. And how did that occur? And is it still part of your daily life?
I was always looking for some, meaning in my life from when I was a teenager, I think, really. And I just started to read, I'd read about, Zen Buddhism. I'd read about anthroposophy. I'd read about Gurdjieff, all these different things, different spiritual possibilities. Just trying to figure out the universe, as we all do, I think. And I eventually came to the Sufis. And I thought that they were very interesting, though. They seemed to mirror my own mind in some ways, and they seemed to have answers that I wanted. And almost as I'm framing these thoughts, they almost literally turn up on my doorstep. They just kind of appear as I'm thinking these ideas. And so, I fall in with the Sufis, and I like the kind of nobility of being that they have, and I'm interested in the philosophy that they have, and I'm still there. I'm still there, and I'm still learning. So it's been been my spiritual path really for the last 45 years.
Well, we've had a year where there hasn't been a lot of live performances. What's that been like for you? And are you anxious to get back to the road?
Well, I'm very anxious to get back. Yes. Every musician I know is chomping at the bit. And I think audiences feel the same way. I think audiences just would love to see a live show at this point. It's been a tough time. Having been on the road forever, for my whole life, how do you deal with that? Suddenly, you're not away half the year. You're not playing to audiences. It's difficult. It's been a great time for writing. I've got lots of writing done, written lots of songs. I've got an EP comes out next month, 6-song EP come out next month. I've got the next couple of albums written. So I'm way ahead of all that stuff.
Do you have a recording studio in your home?
I do, yes, and that's been a godsend as well, to be able to record at home and just acoustic stuff, which has been absolutely great. Writing and recording has been great. The occasional virtual stream has been a great way to keep connected to the audience. That's been a godsend as well. I've got some shows coming up outdoors in July, which is June actually June on the East Coast. I've got some UK festivals in August, and some indoor stuff starting to appear now in the fall. So and of course everything that was going to happen this year has been shoved to next year. So next year is like nonstop. It's like really dense, and I hope all that's going to happen as well. So lots of really exciting things to do next year.
I hope so too. One of the shocking words, the last few words that I read in your book were, "He lives in New Jersey." What? Why do you live in New Jersey, and how long have you lived in New Jersey? Why don't you live in England or California?
Good question. Cherchez la femme. I moved to New Jersey to be with my partner, Sarah Phillips, who's also a singer-songwriter, actress, activist, etc. We might not stay there. I mean, we love to be in London. We're both British. We might spend more time in the UK. I'm speaking to you from the UK right now. This feels like home, as it always has felt like home. I love to have a base in America, and the East Coast is actually very convenient. I lived in California for a long time. I lived in LA for maybe 30 years. Mm-hmm. So this is a change for me, getting back to some real weather,
Yes.
Snow and things, snow and blizzards and all that sort of stuff.
Is it black and white there?
Is it black and white? There's a few colors down there,
Well, the book is called Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 to 1975. And it's not a surprise that it's a brilliant work of art. And the author, my guest, Richard Thompson, thank you so much for chatting with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.